had 10 of them initially, and then when I finished, I came up with an 11th. So let me run through them quickly with you here.
The 10 C's.
The 10 C's plus one of the problems with stocks / the S&P as a store of value.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin and the Bible, a show for Christians who love God's word, care about sound money, and want to learn about the moral case for Bitcoin. Join us as we hold fast to God's word and hodl Bitcoin. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. My name is Simon, and I am here with my Bitcoin brothers, David and Will. How are you guys?
Doing great, Simon.
Having a great one, Simon.
Excellent. Well, today is an important day. Today, we bring to close our season one episodes. And we'd like to summarize a little bit for those of you who may have missed an episode along the way and focus on some of the great questions that have been posed by you, our listening audience. Let's begin by briefly recapping each of our episodes. So in episode one, we talked through our first principles. We are three Christian men of different age and generation, and we have the commonality that we love God, we love the gospel and the truth, and we apply God's word to our lives in every arena. And that's why we talk about both Bitcoin and the Bible, because they both intersect. We're Christians who are advocates for the moral imperative that Christians should embrace God's revealed will for sound money, and that takes us to Bitcoin.
In episode two, we talk about the pursuit of sound money and some of the obstacles of this current debt-based fiat system create and what Christians need to do to educate themselves about it and how can they respond, what must they do, what must they change. We talk about the fact that it's not too late to begin the process of educating yourself. So we believe that once you do this, you will find yourself embracing Bitcoin as God's good gift, as a savings technology to us.
Episode three is one of my favorites and has been one of the favorites of our audience. We entitled it, In the Beginning, Bitcoin as Money, and we offered the story of Bitcoin Island to help you understand the concept of Bitcoin as money without making reference to computers. And it allowed us to help you understand that a ledger-based system of money provides a just, honorable means of storing value for human work.
In episode four, we talk about Bitcoin as technology. We talk about the fact that while it's only 12 years old itself, it has a rich history of about 40 to 50 years of computer science and math that went into it. And it's the culmination of a lot of hard work and trying to understand and create something that could withstand the digital age. In the episode, we also focus on understanding and embracing technology, that it's a biblical pursuit. Believers are called to live out the dominion mandate in Genesis by working to improve the technology in God's creation.
Episode five is called It's All Connected, Bitcoin as the Network. And we really started to get excited about Bitcoin by combining the fact that Bitcoin is money. It is a technology, a savings technology. The next step, though, is to embrace the present and the future, that Bitcoin is the world's first instant clearance open monetary network. And the aspects of Bitcoin as a network really extend the opportunity for us as Christians to hold and use the best form of money and to glorify God by saving, spending, and giving generously in Bitcoin.
Finally, in episode six, we talked about the idea of, can we trust Bitcoin or can Bitcoin be trusted? We talked about the fact that God is truth and he wants his children to balance trust and verification of truth in all arenas of life. Bitcoin is a concept that lends itself to verification of truth, and so Christians can learn about it while sorting through the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that's propagated in the mainstream media and modern financial institutions.
Yes. Now, Will and David, we have gotten a lot of questions, and this has been great for me because we've been collecting these questions and organizing them, and we committed that we would answer many of these questions for you, and we already have done so in some of the flow of our six episodes. But guys, I thought it would be really helpful for us today to select some of the most common questions that we have and go back to them and address them in a little bit more detail today. So, the first one is probably the most popular question that we get, and I smile every time I see it because I know that we have a lot to say about it, but we've refrained from saying it to this point because we really wanted you to understand Bitcoin first before we tried to tie in the question of what about other cryptos? And I in cryptos, I have in air quotes here because that is a terminology that we want you to understand and to be precise and careful about when you discuss Bitcoin. So, let's talk about it, guys. What about other cryptos? Are they something that Christians can or should own or invest in along with Bitcoin?
Can? Of course. There's no prohibition against one wanting to place some money at risk in a certain kind of investment. People buy real estate with the expectation or hope that it'll go up in value and they can turn around and sell it again. People buy stocks, people buy bonds, people buy artwork. There's all kinds of things that people purchase with the hope and the desire and the intention for it to go up in value, fiat dollars, and then turn around and sell it again. So I think we have to acknowledge that, yes, people buy Ethereum, and it has it gone up in fiat dollars? It absolutely has. And so we wouldn't say that one is prohibited from doing that. However...
Yeah, the however is, if you become convinced through study and reading and thinking that these other cryptos are fundamentally a scam that are preying upon people's FOMO and lack of understanding basic economics, and you continue to seek to profit on the backs of people who don't have that understanding, that is unethical. In the same way that it would be wrong for you as a believer to buy and sell a material good to others that you knew was broken and it is being misrepresented, and you are trying to take advantage of a brother who doesn't realize that in order to get some sick fiat gains, it's the same dynamic here. It's often abstracted because you don't see the other person on the other end of this sale. So when you're buying and selling cryptos that are mooning and there are rug pulls and people are losing their livelihoods, it's easy to celebrate that you bought and sold Doge, you know, when you bought it when it was low and sold it when it was high, but who was on the other end of that trade? You don't know. If you were doing that in an attempt to simply make a profit at the expense of others, I think that is unethical.
I would agree.
And let's tie this together here, because I think we're asking really three questions here. One is it immoral for a Christian to own or recommend? And second question we're asking is it an unwise decision? And I think the third question is, if you already own cryptos that are not Bitcoin, what should you do with them, right? Should you continue to hold them or should you sell them and buy Bitcoin? And that's kind of a question that we obviously have to ask and answer is, do we even talk about other cryptos and educate you about them? So let's be clear, for those who are not as fluent in the technology, we're talking about other cryptocurrencies that are things like Ethereum, Ripple, Cardano, Dogecoin. There are hundreds of other mechanisms for using computer science to try to define a value, a store of value. And what we've tried to establish is that at a basic level, Bitcoin is different from all of the other ones, not simply because it's the biggest one. We can't ignore the reality that it is the biggest one and it has survived and grown in market value and has absorbed a lot of the monetary energy from other stores of value. But what we're really pointing to is several practical differences that would make it unwise to hold another form of cryptocurrency, even if you didn't embrace that it was an unethical thing. And I think we've talked about this as well. If you just measure things in terms of how much they grow, you could look at something like Ethereum and say, hey, it's grown a lot this year. All I want to do is hold it for a little while and then turn around and sell it. I'm just in it to provide for my family. That's not what we're about here at Bitcoin and the Bible podcast. We want you to think about it in terms of savings technology, not just investing, not trading, not just trying to make a short-term profit on something. And cryptocurrencies are ways that people have and will continue to make short-term profits. So what we're really talking about is the reality that other cryptocurrencies do not have the same design as Bitcoin. They're not as easily stored, meaning they could take huge amounts more computer data to be able to store and use for long periods of time. They don't have the same decentralized monetary policy that fixes the supply of the currency at a fixed number that cannot be changed or altered or manipulated by a centralized individual or group. So when I first have this conversation with individuals, I try to help educate them about the reality that Bitcoin is different. And then I start to have the conversation that we just had about the implications of that, to say, I'm not telling you that you can't make money in this. What I'm telling you that is, I don't believe that these cryptocurrencies are the wisest and best mechanism to store or save your monetary energy over space and time for your family. And I fully agree that if you knowingly go in and purchase something that you're intending to flip to someone who is not understanding of its nature, then you are at risk of potentially sinning against that individual.
And maybe it'd be helpful for people if we provided like a sorting mechanism so people can more easily understand how to think about the different kinds of cryptos. So generally speaking, I'd say there's two main classifications of cryptos, right? So there's the first, which are those that are trying to be money. And then the second are those that are trying to build a decentralized application or some kind of platform. In terms of those trying to be money, Bitcoin has 92% dominance over all proof of work crypto that are attempting to be money. You can see the current numbers if you go to bitcoindominance.com. We can link that in the show notes, and it'll let you see the main cryptos that are attempting to be money and how Bitcoin is slaughtering them, especially if you exclude Ethereum, which you should, because Ethereum is not money. So in order for something to surpass Bitcoin, right, of these ones that are trying to be money, it would have to not only be a little better, right, but as we've talked about with network effects, it has to be about 10 times better in order to kind of pull things out of the gravitational orbit of that network effect. So the chicken and egg problem here is the security of proof of work tokens come from the amount of real world energy that are put into the mining of that token, right? So a new proof of work token has to figure out, okay, how do we bootstrap that security organically? Because while it's growing, the token isn't valuable enough to justify that level of hash power in order to adequately secure the network. And additionally, any new things that crypto would be trying to do is just going to get absorbed into the Bitcoin protocol, right? Bitcoin is software, it can be upgraded. So if there's some new advancement that is really helpful or beneficial, then it just gets built into Bitcoin or built on top of Bitcoin, which you see with the Bitcoin Lightning Network. Much in the same way that advancements in technology just get added on to the existing internet, it doesn't replace the internet. Advancements in proof of work money tokens will just continue to get added to Bitcoin. And because all of the developer share and the network effect of money causes all of the money to be in Bitcoin already, that's where all of the work will continue to happen, the real serious work. And if there was some improvement that happened outside of Bitcoin, it would just get sucked in and make Bitcoin that much stronger. Then we look at application tokens. And application tokens or utility tokens, they broadly fall into two buckets. There are proof of work tokens, and there are proof of stake tokens. And the functional difference between them is how can we achieve consensus in a distributed, decentralized manner? Bitcoin solved this with proof of work. Proof of work says, hey, we are going to just trust whichever chain has put in the most real world energy into the state of this chain. So that work needs to be rewarded. And so miners of Bitcoin are rewarded in Bitcoin. So a proof of work application or utility token, they can only reward the miners with the currency of that network. So if it is an application token that is seeking to facilitate file storage, they create a token on this network and they can reward the miners with that token. But that token now is both a utility token in terms of facilitating file transfer, but it now has monetary properties. And that causes a problem because there is a network effect to money. So why would someone expend energy on a application utility token that has monetary value instead of going directly to the monetization of Bitcoin? So the big switch has been to proof of stake. And the idea of proof of stake is, okay, let's get rid of all of this wasted energy.
Air quotes,
wasted energy. This hard work that went into proving the history and provenance of this chain. And let's turn around and let's just say, what if the people who have the most to lose if the system collapses are the ones who validate transactions? And that sounds great at first until you stop to realize what we're saying is the rich get to make the rules and enforce the rules. Now, stop me if you've heard of a system where the rich get the exorbitant privilege of making the rules. Oh, wait, that's the fiat system that we're living under right now. The difference is that they have fancy marketing teams to hide the fact that these are all centralized organizations that are just attempting to replace the Fed as the one who's got their greasy little fingers on the money spigot. So when we look at a platform like Ethereum, whose narratives have shifted every 6 months since its inception, lately their big push is on ultrasound money. Because, under the newest rule set of the monetary policy, it's going to be deflationary. And if it's deflationary, then it's better than Bitcoin. Great. Sure, that's an interesting idea. But you've already shown that you can monkey with the monetary policy. And if you can monkey with the monetary policy to make it deflationary, then at the whims of your overlord Vitalik Buterin, you're going to turn around and make it inflationary when it suits him. And if you have a tinkerable monetary policy, you have lost all credibility at being a decentralized distributed money. It just doesn't work. The centralizing forces of Ethereum are what will ultimately kill it. And so what we'll see is Ethereum compromised on decentralization in order to bring features earlier. So building decentralized applications on top of Bitcoin is hard, and so it's taken a long time. People were impatient, so they sacrificed a little bit of the decentralization by saying, okay, we'll store more data, and we're going to put all the applications directly on-chain on the base layer. Great. Now we can build things faster. But guess what? Someone else came along and said, hey, let's sacrifice a little bit more decentralization to make transactions a little bit cheaper and a little bit faster. And then another competitor comes along, and now you have Binance Smart Chain, and you have Tron, and you have Cardano, and you have all of these other chains who are willing to sacrifice a little bit more on the decentralization to make it a little bit faster. And why does this crush Ethereum? Because the network effect of an application can't touch the network effect of money. So if I have my money in Bitcoin, I can't have it in Litecoin simultaneously. But if you have all of these hot swappable chains for applications where developers can move their application from one chain to another, there's no network effect there. People will move and they're happy to do so. They don't care because all of the activities that are happening on these chains are really just monetization of more money spigot hocus pocus. There's no real activity occurring on any of these chains. If we honestly step back and look, there is a reason that Bitcoin has survived and thrived, because it prioritized decentralization and an unchangeable monetary policy. All of these other coins have sacrificed that for one reason or another. And over a long enough time frame, they're dead. They're doomed.
So these are the dot-com companies that appeared to have tremendous upward potential in the dot-com boom, right? Till the balloon popped. And then pets.com disappeared.
Most people don't realize Ethereum had a 70% pre-mine. At launch, 70% of the supply of Ethereum was owned by the Ethereum Foundation and its investors. The reason that these currencies are able to thrive is because they have marketing budgets to pump up the sex appeal with ads and graphics and community building. Bitcoin is boring because there is no marketing team and marketing dollars, because it's a truly decentralized protocol. Ethereum is a security.
So Michael Saylor really succinctly laid it out, and I'll just paraphrase his comments, which were to the effect of, if I launch a new crypto and I give myself and a few of my friends half of the initial supply, and then I pay some celebrity to go promote this token out on social media, right, to pump it up, and then I tell everyone that's this revolutionary new technology, and I sell this token, that's fraud, right? The SEC is fully aware of that. That's an unlicensed security. And Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC, has made it very clear the SEC is going to be coming after these altcoins. And while I don't ever cheer for more government regulation, the important part is that these altcoins are DINO, right? D-I-N-O, decentralized in name only. And when the government comes for them, we're going to find out which of them are actually centralized and which are decentralized. And I think what you're going to see is that they're all centralized.
Yeah, that's really helpful, guys. And just to make sure that we're keeping this accessible for everybody, we'll just kind of remind you that Vitalik Buterin is the founder of Ethereum. Ethereum is the largest competitor to Bitcoin in the space. But as Will has correctly pointed out, pre-mining refers to the fact that when the coins were originally produced, they were offered to individuals for sale or as gifts before they were accessible to the general public. Another way to say that is an initial coin offering or an ICO. And many, if not most, of the alternative cryptocurrencies out there have fallen into the same pattern that Ethereum has provided for them, and therefore are subject to the same criticism. So we are not experts at this, but we commit to you that we are committed to the process of maintaining our knowledge base about how Bitcoin compares to things like Ethereum so that we can continue to help you understand the difference. And we would be happy to recommend resources to you. We'll put in the show notes the link to an excellent Stefan Lavera podcast where he interviews a guy named Alex B. And for those of you who are more technically minded and you don't want to just trust us, you want to verify for yourself, which we totally recommend and respect, then you can definitely go and listen to this and make sure that you're not just hearing this from us and that you can understand it there. But I think in summary, we believe that Bitcoin is the preeminent form of stored value, the hardest form of money, and therefore we differentiate it from cryptocurrencies. In fact, we verbally tend to differentiate it from cryptocurrencies, and we'll be focusing the majority, if not all of our episodes on Bitcoin only. But that does bring us to the next question, which is NFTs or non-fungible tokens. So Will, here, I'm going to lean on your expertise. What are NFTs and is there a future for them with Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's a great question. There has lately been a big marketing push of NFTs and pushing them on the general populace by celebrities. That's not a coincidence. The celebrities have been paid to promote them. So what is an NFT? So an NFT is this idea that what if we could leverage a cryptocurrency which theoretically has an immutable blockchain, and we now enable someone to move a digital token that represents something that is not fungible. So what does that mean? Well, one Bitcoin is always one Bitcoin, right? Every Bitcoin in the Bitcoin network is the same. And your Bitcoin and my Bitcoin are functionally identical in the network. A non-fungible token would be this idea of what if I could digitize an image and I could make, say, three of these images available. And these images, you could buy them and sell them and you could own this picture and we'll store it on the blockchain, right? We've digitized and revolutionized art because now I can prove my ownership of a picture. And the big push you're seeing right now is with digital images. I'm going to own an image. And most of these are horrifyingly hideous pictures of monkeys and rocks and things. I mean, it's primitive. But let's give it the benefit of the doubt and say that the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and these people with awful taste genuinely do love these rocks that they're paying exorbitant prices for. Is there a technical problem with them? Yes. So let's dig into this. What does ownership mean? In the historical classical sense of the word, ownership implies property rights. So if I own something, then I can exert my sovereignty over that object. If I own the Mona Lisa, I can deface the Mona Lisa. I could burn it. I could restrict access to it by putting in a vault. Now, some of you will be quick to say, but what about all the people who've taken pictures of the Mona Lisa? Great. Yep, they own a copy of the Mona Lisa, but I own the original Mona Lisa. And if I destroy it, it's gone. If I alter it, I own the altered copy. An NFT is not the image. The NFT is a reference to an image. So what does that mean? That means that I can own a pointer, a reference to an image that I can then move around. What rights does that confer to me? Can I alter it? No. Can I destroy it? No, the image is everywhere. I just own a copy of it. Can I hide it from people? No, they can right click, save as, and download it. All right, so what property rights do I have over this image? Nothing. I have no sovereignty over this thing that I've purchased. I have sovereignty over a reference to an image, but not the image itself. So it's easier to see that if we apply it to something in the real world. Let's say we put property deeds on the blockchain and we make NFTs of them. So now when I buy a house, it's on the blockchain, as if that's somehow superior. Great. So someone steals your phone and they send the NFT of your property deed to themselves in their wallet. They come and knock on your door and they show it to you and say, look, I'm the owner of your home. Get out. Right? Is that going to happen? No, you're not going to leave your home. You're going to say, I own this. Why? Because ownership of the NFT is not ownership of the home. It is a representation of it, but you are still beholden upon an outside arbitrator to arbitrate the ownership of the home. So what are you going to do? You're going to go to the local government and say, no, I still own the home. Look, here's the history. They stole it from me, right? Well, if code is law, then the government would be forced to say, nope, sorry, he holds the NFT. Get out. It's not your house anymore. That's not going to happen. And B, you don't want that. The problem is you cannot take a real world asset and tie it to a digital representation of it one for one. Bitcoin exists and succeeds because the bearer token of the Bitcoin network, Bitcoin the asset, never leaves the network, and it never tries to leave the network. When I buy and sell Bitcoin, I'm exchanging dollars for Bitcoin. At that point, I now have Bitcoin that I can move around the network, but I'm never tying it to an outside real world object that I'm trying to back with it. This is why gold-backed cryptos could never work, because you can't verifiably take a piece of real world gold and tie it to a digital asset. You can't really own something in the digital world because copying it is trivial. So no, NFTs by and large, they don't really have a future. In their current implementations, the use cases for them are severely limited. And I am open to the idea that there may be some use cases where having a non-fungible token provides some cool opportunities. So I am not saying that every NFT for all time is a scam. To be clear, what I am saying is that the way that NFTs are being promoted as digital ownership of these assets is a scam, and you are not owning that image. So I would be very careful and very hesitant before I plunk down a sizable amount of money to link some asset to a crypto chain, which is just one of many chains. So if you buy an image on Ethereum, who's to prevent them from issuing that same NFT on another chain? There's problems. There's problems all over the place. And in the future, there may be some interesting use cases that haven't been thought of or that I haven't seen yet. But the ones that are dominant right now, no, stay out of it.
Well said, Will. And I think it's important to note that we're not saying that people will not make money short term buying and selling NFTs. That's not our measure of success, nor is that what we're intending to communicate to you. Nor are we saying that Christians should not continue to look ahead at a future where digital property rights and digital technologies will develop to do things that we have not seen or conceptualized today. We believe that they could. But what Will is trying to help you understand right now is that we do not believe that the design of NFTs today, regardless of which cryptocurrency they are currently linked to, provides a legitimate means of storing or using that value that you could potentially invest in it today. All right. Now, this is going to be a good one. This is a big question, but one I think that we have answered in part, but we'd like to return to that answer and flesh it out in a little bit more detail to make sure that we're clear. Again, we definitely want to be accountable to all of you. And we've received a question that I'll summarize in the following way. It says, isn't investing in the stock market, and particularly the S&P 500, the fastest growing portion of the stock market currently, I think it's grown a little bit over double since last year, an easier way for individuals to protect and grow their money than Bitcoin? Isn't it easier? And isn't it more difficult for those of us who don't know Bitcoin to learn Bitcoin than to simply passively invest in something like the S&P 500 or the stock market in general? So let's stop and think about that question. Why not just invest in the stock market and do it that way? It's just as profitable, right?
This is a question that I've been waiting to address. So let's lay down a few facts first before we go forward with that. So the S&P 500 represents at this point in time about 80% of the market value of the entire U.S. equities market. The top 10 companies within the S&P 500 amount to, at the moment, around 28.5% of that index. So there's tremendous concentration. And in fact, if you drop it down another level to the FANG stocks, and there's about six of them, and I think the last number I saw was around 19% of the entire S&P index was made up of those particular stocks. So there's tremendous concentration within a very narrow segment. Beyond that, if you go to the Federal Reserve website, the St. Louis Fed, which has all kinds of wonderful charts that you can look at and pull information off of, if you, and I did this morning, if you go into the Fed website there and you ask them for a chart of the Standard and Poor's Index, the S&P Index, and the debt levels of the Federal Reserve Bank, and they'll superimpose them onto the same graph, what you will see is that the S&P has indeed risen and has risen dramatically, but it overlaid with the increase in debt, which is essentially money creation by the Federal Reserve, you see a very close correlation. So has the S&P gone up since the great financial crisis? Yes, it's gone up a lot. Why has the S&P gone up? significantly so because of so many currency units being flooded into the system. As Milton Friedman said in 1994, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomena. So we have seen tremendous inflation of the value of the S&P index. Why? Because of the tremendous inflation of the monetary base by the Federal Reserve. So could you have put money to work into an S&P index and watched it grow tremendously? Absolutely, you could. There's no question about it. However, is that a means to preserve and transfer wealth over periods of time? Again, back to something we laid down fundamentally a long time ago in this podcast, that money is a means to store your labor. So you work, you expend your life energy at work, you are rewarded for that work in money, and then you use money as an asset, as a good, as a means to store that energy for future purposes, whether that's for your own future financial needs or those of your legacy. So a way to move your hard-earned labor intergenerationally. So just thinking about all of that with regard to the S&P, I made up a list of problems with the S&P as a store of value. And I would say this is generally true of stocks and the S&P at large. So being a preacher at heart, they all begin with C. So I had 10 of them initially, and then when I finished, I came up with an 11th. So let me run through them quickly with you here.
The 10 C's.
The 10 C's plus one of the problems with stocks/the S&P as a store of value. So here they are. Let's just rattle them off. Number one is company risk. Company risk. In other words, can the particular company that's represented, or in the case of the S&P, the 10 companies that make up nearly a third of the index, can they execute their business strategy? Can they execute it this year, next year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years into the future? There's company risk. Secondly, there's competitor risk. In other words, will another company overtake them? And we can talk about numerous examples of companies, large companies, household names that were once part of the S&P index that don't even exist anymore. And so you have competitor risk. Third, you have CEO risk. In other words, no one lives forever. And so the present CEO of a particular company, and again, with the concentration in the S&P, you see the same thing. With CEO risk, no one lives forever. And what happens when he steps down? He retires. He gets sick. He drops dead. Fourth is country risk. Country risk. In other words, what if the country in which this particular company or index is substantially located changes their laws with regard to property rights, changes their tax policies? That can certainly go down to individual levels at the state and local level, but I'll just leave it at country risk. You have tremendous country risk. Fifth is currency risk. Currency risk. The earnings are concentrated in a single currency. So all of the potential fluctuations in the value of that currency adhere to the stocks that are enumerated in that currency. Six, you have central bank risk. In other words, rising interest rates affect the discount rate, or falling interest rates affect the discount rate by which the stocks are valued. And I would say the same thing for bonds. So you have central bank risk, that you have no control over what they're doing with interest rates. Seventh, you have counterparty risk. And by that, what I mean is that a third party holds the stock certificates. You do not hold them. And so you are dependent upon a third party being there and executing for you in order for you to be able to buy and sell positions. And if there's any kind of a market disruption, potentially the third party that's holding your digital representation of ownership could disappear and you could find yourself in a real mess.
Or like we saw with Robinhood just a few months ago, they could just shut down trading in the middle of the day.
There you go. So counterparty risk. Eight is contagion risk. Contagion risk. In other words, in a falling market, authorities can gate the on and off ramps or even shut down entire exchanges. And in our own history, we've seen situations where trading has been halted for a period of time. What if you're trying to get in or get out at that particular time? And you have an authority figure that blocks the ramps. Nine is convenience risk. I call it convenience risk. In other words, you can only buy and sell during certain pre-prescribed business hours. as opposed to Bitcoin, which is 24/7, 365, anywhere in the world. Try to move stocks, try to get in and out of stock positions on a Saturday night somewhere. It just can't be done. 10th is conveyance risk. Conveyance risk. In other words, you're depending upon a trusted third party to transfer ownership and for you to achieve final settlement again. So you're back to having a trusted third party, whether it's a bank or a brokerage house or whatever, to arrange the transfer of ownership here and for you to get final settlement. And then there was one more I just threw in, which was what I'm calling concentration risk. And that is the fact that the S&P now is so heavily concentrated in just a few companies. And should one or more of these companies stumble, then the entire index will suffer. They used to say that when General Motors sniffled, the entire economy caught a cold. Well, that was the back in the day when General Motors actually made things in this country. And you could almost say the same thing now. Should any one of the FANG stocks have a sniffle, then the entire market catches a cold. So have people historically done well by index investing? Absolutely. They've grown their fiat dollars. Is it a way to generationally move money? I think the risks associated with it are just tremendous and not reliable, for sure. If you had owned shares of Sears and Roebuck at one point in time, the largest retailer in the country, in the world, you wouldn't have anything now. So there's tremendous risk associated with it. And so, no, I don't think the S&P in any way can compete with Bitcoin.
It's an investment versus savings.
It's an investment versus savings.
So it's not to say that investing in the S&P is inherently wrong.
No, not at all. We're not making a moral case here. We are now making a business case.
But within that, we are also differentiating investing from savings and pointing out that people in our world today have been forced to look at investment in equities as a savings mechanism because it is one of the few things that has kept up or exceeded the rate of inflation. And therefore, they have no other choice but to look at the stock market as a means of savings. But let's draw two other points out of that. The first of which, and I think it's Greg Foss who says this really, really well, in the event that a company goes under, those who own stock are not at the top of the ladder with regards to redeeming that. Those who own the company's bonds are ahead of them in that order of priority. So if you own stock in a company, yes, you do own something, but you're not likely to necessarily get all of your money back if that company goes under. Others will be ahead of you in line in the clearance of debts. And secondly, we obviously speak to a predominantly U.S.-based audience. More than 90% of our users are in the U.S. and can take advantage of the stock market. But we know that we're speaking to many of you who are outside of the United States and may not have access to the U.S.-based stock market. So for those of you who do not have an S&P index to invest in that's been growing based upon the inflation of the U.S. dollar, we obviously want you to think about it in bigger picture terms there. And we encourage those of you who are in the U.S. to think globally. Think as Christians. Think on behalf of your neighbor and say, where is the value of the world's money being stored? Great. So we have another question that is similar to that, but not the same. The question is, isn't it wise, particularly for Christians, but for anyone, to diversify your assets so as not to put all of your eggs into one imaginary basket? So let's talk about that question of diversification.
The saying goes that we diversify to preserve, we concentrate to grow. And a typical diversified portfolio is a 60-40 bond stock portfolio. That's what the legacy system would push you to. Now, as we sit around the table here, we're at different ages, we're at different generations, we have different needs. You know, my children are all long grown and with children of their own. And so the needs of my wife and I are different than you will, who have young children. And so from my perspective, I do diversify. I'm not widely diversified, but I have some diversification. And an advantage of diversification is that it does help smooth out, if you properly diversify, it does help smooth out some of the short-term movements up and down of an asset in a particular marketplace. So I don't think you can just, you know, bang the table and say diversification is wrong, you should never do it. But I think the extent of one's diversification is related to one's time horizons and needs for whatever money they're setting aside.
And I think a lot of this question comes from people viewing Bitcoin as an investment. So oftentimes in investments, you do want to diversify a little bit, right? Most people who hold stocks don't hold a single stock or don't hold shares in a single company. They want to broaden the basket a little bit. But if Bitcoin is savings, how many people diversify their money, right? Most people don't go and say, I'm going to hold a basket of foreign currencies as a means of diversifying my savings. So most people just hold dollars and dollar-denominated assets. Bitcoin is savings. Bitcoin is the best money. And thus, for your monetary needs, I would argue that Bitcoin is the best place that you can store your money. If you'd like to go out and invest in something, go invest in something. I'm not going to tell you not to do that. I think that you can make a business case that Bitcoin is a better return than most investments today, and that because of the central bank's actions, that the market is completely irrational. And so I wouldn't step foot in it, but that doesn't mean that it's morally wrong to do so. But Bitcoin as savings, Bitcoin is the best money, and thus you store your wealth in the best money.
Yeah, I would embrace what God says to us in Proverbs to be prudent, to look ahead and say, what's the risk that something could happen to me in the next couple of months, in the next couple of years? And how am I as a man, and as a father and a husband prepared for that risk? Do I have liquidity? Do I have the ability to change my savings to give me access to my daily basic needs? Bitcoin provides that for us today. It's not like if you buy Bitcoin, you cannot turn around and sell it and gain the liquidity and fiat that you need to be able to go to the store and buy milk and eggs. I think that's a misconception that prevents people from looking at Bitcoin as a true savings technology. But to go back to what we were thinking about previously, if you're thinking about diversification from an investment perspective and saying, okay, would I hold one company's stock versus a variety of companies and basically make the educated wager that on the whole, these companies are going to grow as a group? The way to think about it as well is to recognize that more often than not, diversification results in people selling the winners to buy the losers. And I think that's where we need to be careful in not looking at diversification as a catch-all strategy that basically guarantees you growth over time. There are no guarantees in this world, right? Other than God is coming back someday and you need to know Jesus Christ and his word is true. But we do recognize that as fallible men investing in fallible companies and dealing with fallible institutions, governments, and banks, there will be errors made. There will be winners. There will be losers. And the free market should punish the losers and reward the winners. So if you are looking at your savings and saying, what is the safest way to store the monetary energy that I have put into it, we are obviously all in convictionally that God has given us providentially the best mechanism of storing in Bitcoin. And therefore, our diversification mixes here tend to be a little higher in Bitcoin than many of you would be accustomed to. But we're not opposed to diversification morally or practically. Here's an interesting question. And we've sought to answer this already, but we're going to ask and answer it again. Does Bitcoin meet the standards of being an equal weight and measure per Proverbs chapter 20, verse 10, which is one of several verses within the scriptures and specifically in Proverbs that points to God's design for money? God would hate those who would be dishonest and unjust in their use of unequal weights and measures. So does Bitcoin meet that standard?
Proverbs 20 and verse 10, according to the NASB, says, differing weights and differing measures, both of them are an abomination to the Lord. Literally, a stone and a stone, an ephah and an ephah. So what the proverb is pointing to is the fact that, Simon, if you buy an ephah of grain, it needs to weigh X number of ounces. And William, if you buy an ephah, then yours should be X minus or X plus, that as a merchant, you need to sell equally to your customers. Because why? Because that reflects the integrity and character of God. So That statement, we believe, has implications for commerce at large, but primarily first interpretation, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the marketplaces. Don't put your thumb on the scale.
Don't cheat those whom you are doing transactions with by treating them differently.
Yes.
And in that sense, if we're very precise, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. What I choose to purchase it for versus what you choose to purchase it for in dollars or whatever currency I'm using can change and will change. But I'm still purchasing Bitcoin in the same equal increments that you are purchasing at. And my access to do so is the same. There's no preferential treatment given to some versus others to say, oh, you can buy more Bitcoins for the same rate than this person does just because you happen to have a different form of access.
Yes, and that's the inherent injustice of the present worldwide fiat system is that those who are close to the centers of power receive the currency units first and allow them to spend them into the economy or before anybody else realizes the reality that all of the currency units that they've worked for and saved in have now been debased. Why? Because they keep changing the fraction.
And I think that point that you're making really segues into the last question, which is, can we address the Tower of Babel concern that Bitcoin could be a one world government or one world money tool that's dangerous? So looking back to what you said of governments have the ability to print the money and those who are closer benefit disproportionately, I think it's an interesting question to ask yourself. Is it that governments have the authority to print money, or is it that those with the power to print money become the governments? And when you look over history, what you see is those who have access to control the money control the power. And so what is Bitcoin? Ultimately, it's a divorce of the power structures of money from the state. So if no one can control the printing press of money, there is no centralizing control of Bitcoin. There is no central bank of Bitcoin. There is no one who can inflict monetary injustice through an arbitrary policy via Bitcoin. So it is the anti-Tower of Babel. It is not a one world government. It is a no government world where the money is truly equitably distributed by the needs of the free market and not at the whims of the privileged few.
Agreed. And I think it's important for us as Christians to recognize that God loves freedom in the fact that he has given us the freedom that we enjoy to worship him and to do so in whatever country of the world that we live in, the freedom to work different jobs and to transact in different currencies. God is not a dictatorial God that gives us only a specific framework with which we must work within. With freedom comes the accountability to abide by his will. And when we go to scripture, we do not see that God's will excludes the possibility of a specific currency or money being used in multiple countries around the world simultaneously. In fact, obviously, gold has been used as a money and a currency in many of the countries of the world that the biblical record records for us simultaneously. So we do not fear that form of money, that money that spreads across the world, as much as we appreciate that it will and it could be one of the best ways for us as Christians to store our value, our work, and our time in a way that honors and glorifies our Creator God. As we conclude today, we want to thank you all for your questions, and we want to encourage you to continue with us as we move into season two. We'll be taking some time to dig deep into God's Word. And we would look forward to sharing that time with you. So we thank you for your support and your encouragement. And we in turn want to encourage you to trust God, love Christ, and love your neighbor, and save in Bitcoin.